Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm so glad we could shoehorn you all in here. I guess we'll have to move to the Coliseum next time. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. As some of you who have been here before know, the Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures, seminars, and debates that we conduct here in the Bay Area, and especially here at our conference center in Oakland. Our program today is entitled The Real Abraham Lincoln, A Debate. We're featuring the books A New Birth of Freedom by Harry Jaffa, which is, I'd say, one of the most important books done on Lincoln. And those of you who know about Harry Jaffa's work will understand what I mean. The second book that we're featuring is the book called The Real Lincoln by Tom DiLorenzo, which is a challenge to many traditional views of Lincoln. As many of you know, the Independent Institute regularly holds programs like this. We're also very grateful when we do that Robert Mondavi Winery is very kind to donate the wine that we enjoy. For those of you who are new to the Institute, in the registration packet you'll find information about our program. The Independent Institute is a public policy research institute. We organize many conference and media programs. We sponsor many studies on major public policy research areas and economic and social issues. On our homepage, you can also listen to many of the transcripts and listen to many of the events from past Institute events. One of our publications is the quarterly journal called The Independent Review. This is the current issue. The cover story is on the coming destruction of medical privacy in the United States. Also in your program, you'll find information about tonight's program, as well as a notice of our next event, which is going to be scheduled on June 6th. It's called Big Brother is Watching. The speaker will be James Bamford, who's currently a distinguished visiting faculty member at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of the new book, Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. Many of you may be familiar with his earlier book called Puzzle Palace, also on the NSA, which broke a great deal of ground and surprised many people who didn't even know that the NSA existed. Also, you'll find in your packet information about our summer seminars for high school and college students. This year we're holding two seminars. They're being co-sponsored with Holy Names College here in Oakland. The dates for those programs are July 17th to the 21st. Oh, I'm sorry, June 17th to the 21st. Carl Close is our academic affairs director. And also August 12th to the 16th. And students who participate can also earn a one-hour college course credit in economics. And we hope that if you know young people, that you'll steer them that way. For this evening, we're quite pleased to have two top figures who will be discussing one of the most revered and derided figures in American history. Our program features two scholars who will discuss their books and differing views. The topic of tonight's program, actually I didn't get a chance to tell you, but I thought we should change it based on some new research that's just come out. The Weekly World News has just announced that Abraham Lincoln was a woman. And I'm not sure if you've seen this research yet. The significance of this is that Abraham Lincoln is one of the seminal figures in American history, and a popular publication like this can make mockery of him and issues, and it doesn't really affect the legacy and the ideas and the controversy that surrounds him. Most Americans, in fact, consider Abraham Lincoln to be the greatest president in history. His legend as a great emancipator has grown to almost mythic proportions as hundreds of books, as well as the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C., extol his heroism, and so forth. The question is Lincoln's reputation deserved? In his book, Lincoln scholar Harry Jaffa argues that Lincoln was a model statesman who stuck by high-minded principles as he fought to promote liberty. Lincoln critic Tom DiLorenzo argues that Lincoln was a calculating politician who waged the bloodiest war in American history, not to free the slaves, but in order to build an empire. Was Lincoln a great hero, or a villain, or both? Did he honor the promise of America, or did he betray it? So we're delighted to have these two scholars here with us. The format we thought we would use for the debate is that each of our speakers will speak for 30 minutes, followed by a 5-minute response, and then we'll open it up to questions from you and the audience. We also ask that the debate remain gentlemanly. No kicking, biting, spitting.
Harry has been here before.
Our program is a battle of ideas, and it's between two men. Two men of goodwill, who incidentally both share the abolitionist tradition of ending slavery. So I'd like to introduce our first speaker. I'm very pleased to introduce Harry V. Jaffa. Harry is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Political Philosophy Emeritus at Claremont McKenna College and Claremont Graduate University. He received his PhD from the New School for Social Research. He's been a fellow of the Ford, Rockefeller, Guggenheim, and Earhart Foundations. In addition to his most recent book, A New Birth of Freedom, he's the author of the most widely, perhaps the most influential single book on Lincoln and the Lincoln-Douglas debate called The Crisis of the House Divided. His other books include Equality and Liberty, The Conditions of Liberty, of Freedom, Storm Over the Constitution, Thomism and Aristotelianism, and many others. It's a great pleasure to introduce Harry Jaffa.
Thank you. And on the question of the gentlemanliness of the debate, I'm reminded Congress just before the Civil War, the senator from New Hampshire, I think, made an anti-slavery speech, and a senator from Mississippi, not Jefferson Davis, invited him to come down to Mississippi to make that speech, promising to see that he was hanged from the highest tree in the forest. The senator from New Hampshire invited the senator from Mississippi to come to New Hampshire, where he would be given a respectful hearing in every township in that state. When people speak about the results of the 1860 presidential election, the vote, for example, it's usually given out that Lincoln had, I think, 39% of the popular vote in that election. But of course, there were 10 states in the South who formed part of the 11 states of the Confederacy in which no Republican electors were on the ballots. And since we know that at least 100,000 men from those states came north to join the Union Army, there were at least 100,000 votes that weren't counted. But the South became a closed society on the eve of the Civil War, and it became a closed society after the end of Reconstruction. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute for some time circulated a book edited by my late friend Mel Bradford, The Essays of Andrew Lytell, who was one of the Southerners who took their stand in 1931, I think it was. And one of those essays, written in 1934, praised lynching as a legitimate exercise of the reserve powers of the states when the government didn't fulfill their duty in taking care of racist agitators. So the South was a closed society on the subject of race right up until World War II. And the Lincoln in the Cooper Union speech, which he gave in February of 1860, raised the question, what can we do to satisfy our Southern brethren? No assurances that we give them that we will have no intention of interfering with the institution of slavery where it exists will satisfy them. We must get rid of all anti-slavery sentiments from our state constitutions. I should mention, by the way, that President Buchanan, in his last in his December speech, State of the Union speech, December 1860, said that unless the northern states, and there were eight of them that had laws trying to protect black people who were free from being kidnapped as slaves, because under the law of 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act, if a Southerner came across from Virginia into Pennsylvania and saw a black man that he thought he would like to have as a slave, he had to say, well, that's my runaway slave. And this runaway slave would then be arrested and confined, and then there would be a hearing before a federal commissioner. And the would-be slave owner could summon witnesses, as many as he wanted. The man accused of being a slave could summon no witnesses, had no counsel. And if the federal commissioner decided he was a slave, he was paid $10. And if he decided he was a free man, he was paid $5. It's hard to imagine any law passed that either Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia, which was more inconsistent with the principles of civil liberty than the Fugitive Slave Act. Lincoln, as we know, supported that act as part of the Compromise of 1850, but in his inaugural address, he mentioned several respects in which that law should be modified so that it would be consistent, at least, with the principles of civil liberty. But that was the temper of the country and the different relationship between them towards the attitude, towards the institution of slavery. Now, my friend Tom DiLorenzo here thinks that slavery was not the real issue in the Civil War, that it was the Whig economic program, tariffs, internal improvements, and what he calls corporate welfare. And he thinks that the slavery question was really only a sham, which was not the real question. It was not the real thing at issue between the sections. Well, it's very strange for anybody reading the Lincoln-Douglas debates to find that the subject of tariffs is never mentioned. The only time the word is used, I think, is when Douglas says that the tariff was one of the questions that the two parties used to discuss. But the only subject discussed in the Lincoln-Douglas debates was slavery in the territories. And it's important to understand the sequence of events and the ideas that accompanied that sequence of events that led up to the Civil War. And the subtitle of my new book is Abraham Lincoln and the Coming of the Civil War. And I believe I've discussed the question of the nature of secession and the role of secession in that crisis, I believe, more thoroughly than I think it's ever been discussed before. Tom DiLorenzo, in his book, thinks that the right of secession is and the right of revolution, that's a semantic difference. Well, it was not a semantic difference. It was a fundamental difference. The right of revolution is referred to in the Declaration of Independence when it says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, meaning the security of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the people have a right to alter or abolish it and institute new government, such as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. That is what has been referred to ever since as the right of revolution. It's the right to resist intolerable oppression. It's the right to prevent anyone from being reduced under absolute despotism, which is what the Declaration of Independence says. And this declaration gives a long catalog of the abuses and usurpations of power practiced by the King and Parliament of Great Britain, which justify the colonies in their rebellion. See, the colonists did not, at this point, claim any privileges under the law of Great Britain. They were breaking from the law of Great Britain. They were appealing instead to the laws of nature and of nature's God. And it was under those laws that they had the right to resist oppression. In 1860, the South did not appeal to the right of revolution. They appealed to a right of secession, which they claimed to be a constitutional right under the Constitution itself. See, in 1776, the colonists did not claim that in breaking with Great Britain, they were exercising a right granted by the British Constitution. They had conducted their struggle until that moment by appealing to the British Constitution, but when they decided on independence, they appealed instead to the laws of nature and of nature's God. Now, there were many reasons why the South did not appeal to the right of revolution. One reason was because they had no there were no abuses which they'd been subject to, which comparable to the ones enumerated in the Declaration of Independence. Lincoln, in his inaugural address, said that there was not a single constitutional right which anybody could point to say that had been violated. They were exercising this right as something that was to their pleasure, for their own purposes, but they had nothing to do with the Constitution. And yet they were claiming it as a constitutional right to withdraw from the Union. Now, the issue of the Civil War, as Lincoln presented it in both his inaugural address on March 4th and in the message to Congress in special session on July 4th, 4 months later, was in essence this. If a minority, well, let me start again. In ratifying the Constitution, each state had committed itself to accepting the results of elections conducted under the rules of the Constitution. The election of 1860 had been conducted under the rules of the Constitution. If there were any violations of those rules, it was by the Southern states in refusing to allow Republican electors on the ballot. But there was nothing which the Republican Party had done. There was nothing in the electoral procedures of the free states, or for that matter of the slave states, with this exception, which justified anyone in saying that the results of this election were not constitutional results. If a minority losing an election can break up the government rather than accept the results of the election, free government is impossible. If the only alternatives to rule by a constitutional majority, I say constitutional majority, a majority formed under the rules of the Constitution, with minority rights secured. There were no examples of the Republicans doing anything to prevent the opposition from having freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of association. There was a great deal of interference with those rights in the Southern states, but they lost the election according to their own lights. And Lincoln said that if people can break up the government rather than accept the results of a fairly conducted election, then the only alternatives are anarchy or tyranny. What is to prevent, he said, any one of the states seceding from any future union? So that was the basic issue, that once the ballots have decided, Lincoln said, the only recourse must be to future elections in which the minority can try to become the majority. But there can be no right to reject the results of an election conducted under the rules of the Constitution. Now, let me trace for a moment the sequence of events that led up to the secession crisis. I'll begin by saying that the decisive act of secession, the secession which caused all future secession, was not what happened after Lincoln's election. It was the secession of the seven states of the Deep South from the Democratic Convention in Charleston of 1860. As far as I know, Mr. DiLorenzo doesn't even know anything about this. He can comment on it when he wants to. But what happened then? A majority of the delegates to that convention wanted to nominate Stephen A. Douglas as the Democratic candidate for presidency. The Democratic Party had the two-thirds rule, which they continued to have until 1936, as a matter of fact. I think only in 36 did they change it to a simple majority. Franklin D. Roosevelt's first nomination had to be two-thirds. The seven states of the Deep South, the same seven states that seceded after Lincoln's election and before his inauguration, demanded as a plank in the Democratic platform, without which they would not support Douglas, a slave code for the territories. Now there's a little story to that. Chief Justice Taney, in the Dred Scott decision, had said that the Dred Scott decision, which said that the Missouri Compromise restriction of slavery in 1820 and any other one was unconstitutional, that there was no power in the Congress to forbid slavery in the territories. Then he added, as a kind of obiter dictum, that the only power of Congress over slavery in the territories was the power coupled with the duty of protecting the owner and his rights. Now, the seven states of the Deep South interpreted that to mean that the police power of the federal government had to guarantee the integrity of the property of any slave owner going into any United States territory. This, by the way, was a demand for the greatest increase of federal power prior to the New Deal, maybe even since the New Deal. The greatest demand for an increase in federal power was made by the southern states in 1860. And when the majority in the convention refused to adopt this, and they refused to adopt it because nobody could be elected dog catcher in the free state who supported a federal police power over slavery in the territories. But remember, bear this in mind, this demand meant, if this demand had been acceded to, that meant that every territory in the United States, which would become a state, and remember where there were then 33 states, and there would be 50 states eventually, but every other state would become a slave state. Because if one slave owner went to North Dakota with his slave, the federal police power would follow him to make sure that he could hold that slave securely in that place. Now, this was a demand for the indefinite extension of slavery. So the choice between facing the country was whether slavery will be restricted or whether it will be extended indefinitely, with the whole power of the federal government behind the extension of slavery. And what this could mean is illustrated by what happened in 1854. The first real test of the Fugitive Slave Act. There was a slave named Anthony Burns in Virginia who stowed away on board a coastal vessel, which then sailed to Boston. And Anthony Burns, who was apparently quite literate but not very smart, wrote a letter to his brother back in Virginia telling him where he was. Well, before Anthony Burns was returned to the state of Virginia, the president, Franklin Pierce, had sent a regiment, an artillery regiment of Marines to Boston. He had federalized the National Guard of the state of Boston. He had 3,000 soldiers surrounding them, making sure that nobody could break the jail and let Anthony Burns out. This was an example of the way in which the federal police power would be used to make sure that slaves were returned to their masters or that slaves couldn't escape from their masters. So this is the real issue. Now, what was Douglas's position? Douglas was the man who in 1854, in drafting and sponsoring the Kansas-Nebraska Act, had moved for the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. So the Missouri Compromise restriction on slavery, and that meant that After Missouri was entered, was admitted to the Union in 1820 or 21, the Congress resolved that in all the remaining territory north of 3630, which was the southern boundary of Missouri, that all the remaining territory would be forever free. That meant that the states of Kansas, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming slavery was excluded from them. So the repeal of the Missouri Compromise opened that whole territory to the ingress of slavery. That sparked the greatest political revolution in American history. In the spring of 1854, when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed, there was no Republican Party. There were no Republican congressmen. In the four elections of 1854, 100 Republican congressmen were returned to the Congress. At that moment, Stephen A. Douglas was looked upon as the Antichrist from the point of view of the anti-slavery movement. 3 years later, in the contest for Kansas, when the administration, headed by James Buchanan now, tried to railroad through a constitution called the Lecompton Constitution, which would have made Kansas a slave state, but on the basis of a phony vote, Douglas, sticking to his popular sovereignty doctrine, which meant that the people of the territory, in a fair vote, would decide for or against slavery. That was his way in which he replaced the Missouri Compromise restriction. It opened slavery, but it said that the decision in each territory would be made by the people in that territory on the basis of their preferences. Well, the administration led by Buchanan, who came from Pennsylvania but was one of the famous doughface presidents, that's me, a northern man with southern principles, Douglas became the leader of the Republicans in the struggle in Congress to defeat the Lecompton Constitution, and he succeeded. And from becoming the Antichrist of the anti-slavery movement, he became the savior. And many people in the Republican Party wanted the Lincoln and the Republicans in Illinois to support Douglas for re-election. That was a decisive moment in Lincoln's career, and that's what the situation he faced when he got up to give his House Divided speech in June 16th of 1858. It was a crisis of his own career. It was also, in my opinion, the gravest crisis this country has ever faced, because the greatest danger to the future of the country came not, I think, from the pro-slavery argument, but from the morally neutral argument of Douglas. And that's a long story, and you'll find it all spelled out in great detail in my book, which I hope you will read with great care. But in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln accomplished something almost miraculous. That is to say, what he had to do was to fight off the challenge of Douglas from the Republican side, and at the same time drive a wedge between Douglas and the Southern Democrats. I compared his achievement in that to Stonewall Jackson's Valley Campaign, where Jackson fought two federal armies, beat them both, and kept them close to Washington while he joined Lee before Richmond for the final battle of the 7 days. It was a case of tactical and strategic cleverness and profundity, which is unrivaled in world history. Lincoln's last words in the Lincoln-Douglas debates were, he challenged Douglas, and Douglas accepted Dred Scott. In Dred Scott, the Chief Justice had said that the right to own slaves is expressly affirmed in the Constitution. And Lincoln said it was implied but not expressly affirmed. The argument against any restriction on slavery was that any right expressly affirmed in the Constitution takes precedence of any law or regulation in any jurisdiction whatever. Remember, the Supremacy Clause in Article 6 of the Constitution says that this Constitution and the laws and treaties made in pursuance thereof are the supreme law of the land. Anything in any law or constitution of any state to the contrary notwithstanding, see. And Lincoln pointed out that this argument, which the court applied to the territories, could also equally well be applied to the states. So that the prospect of slavery becoming national, not only through the spread into the new territories, but in the spread to the states, was very great. This was Lincoln's argument. Now, Lincoln said to Douglas, if you accept Taney's opinion that slavery is expressly affirmed in the Constitution is true, then you are under an obligation to give the slave owners the rights to the implementation of this right. The parallel example was the Fugitive Slave Act. Article 4 of the Constitution says any person held to service or labor in any state escaping to another state shall not be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be returned to the one to whom the service or labor is due. This is the favorite fugitive slave clause of the Constitution. Now, the clause of the Constitution doesn't say how this right is to be enforced, but it says it shall be done. And from 1793 to 1850, this was left to the interstate comity that depended upon the states honoring the act. Well, that was not working, and so this federal law was substituted, which provided enforcement procedures under the auspices of the federal government. And Lincoln said, if you believe that in the Fugitive Slave Act being required by Article 4, you must also believe that the protection of the slave owner in the territories deserves federal protection. The two arguments were perfectly parallel. And when Douglas denied, Douglas said it didn't matter how the Supreme Court in the abstract decided the question of slavery in the territories. If the slave owner went to the territory, he had to get local regulations to protect his property. And Lincoln said that by your own argument, if the local regulations are not forthcoming, you must support the federal enforcement. If you don't, you're taking the same position as the abolitionists who denied any obligation to enforce the Fugitive Slave Law. Lincoln's last words in the Lincoln-Douglas debates were, why is there not such an abolitionist as Senator Douglas after all? Well, this may have, it's not clear how persuasive this argument was in Illinois, but it was very persuasive in Mississippi and Alabama and Florida and South Carolina, who said, well, Lincoln's right, this man Douglas is denying us our constitutional rights. See, and as a result of that, it was Lincoln's cleverness in the debates which split the Democratic Convention in Charleston in 1860, and this is what in fact elected Abraham Lincoln. But it was the rebellion against Douglas, not against Lincoln, see, which precipitated the whole secessionist movement. They would not accept, and the South, it's been well said and about many people in many circumstances, that whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. These people in the Deep South were mad because they could have elected Douglas, and Douglas would have given them everything they wanted, you see. Everything that they wanted that was consistent with his election in the free states, you see. Douglas was a radical expansionist. Both parts of the Democratic Party in 1860 called for the annexation of Cuba. And there were 100,000 slaves in Cuba. And Cuba was the place that slaves were still being brought from Africa and then resold in the United States. So it was, and under Douglas presidency, we would have taken over the rest of Mexico and Central America whenever we had the resources and the appetite to do so. And Douglas didn't believe that inferior races, you can be sure that the most of the Mexicans would have either been reduced to peonage or to slavery, because in the Mexican War itself, in case you don't know it, we appropriated 60% of the land area of Mexico as it was then defined through the Spanish conquests. So we increased the size of the United States by 40% and reduced Mexico by 60%. And so the appetite for slavery expansion was, and the possibilities were almost endless. And Douglass would have done these things, but he couldn't subscribe to the slave code. And on that basis, they seceded, and that split the Democratic Party, and that elected Abraham Lincoln. Now, Lincoln's position was consistent throughout the debates. A great deal is said, Dr. Lorenzo says it, but it's been said countless times before, that Lincoln used racist language in the debates. That's not true. What Lincoln said was that what he argued for in the debates was a recognition of the natural rights of black people. When Douglass said that if the people of Nebraska are good enough to govern themselves, they certainly are good enough to govern a few miserable Negroes. And Lincoln replied by saying, "I doubt not that the people of Nebraska are as good as the average of people elsewhere. What I say is that no man is good enough to govern another without his consent." That was the line he took, and he did not try to settle the matter of what would be done if universal emancipation came. No intelligent politician tries to raise questions which will divide his followers. He tries to take positions which will unite his followers. And Lincoln did the best that anybody could have possibly done to unite his followers on questions of principle which applied directly to the great issue of public policy, which at that time was slavery in the territories. Well, I think my time is up, so.
Thank you very much, Harry.